I'm Marty Moss Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. There's a silly game I play when I'm waiting at the airport for a flight. I look at the other passengers to see if I am in an airplane disaster movie. Will I be flying with a newlywed couple, a child with a serious disease, a nun, an aging movie star, a soldier, a scientist, a bickering husband and wife? You know, all the stereotypes you see in those scary movies. Fear of flying is a common condition in part because we don't understand how planes work and we're not in control. Our guest, Mark Van Honecker, has had a lifelong love of planes and flying. He became a pilot in 2003 and now flies 747s out of London on long flights all over the world. He writes about the wonders and joys of flying in his new book, Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times and a columnist for Slate, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Mark Van Honecker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you understand fear of flying?
No, I understand. I was always too obsessed with my love of flying to focus on such things. But of course, like every pilot, I love the movie Airplane.
Do you really?
I suppose it's an airplane disaster movie, but it's certainly one of the best movies about flying, I think.
Well, it's certainly hilarious. As you write, you've had really a lifelong love affair with airplanes, I guess like a lot of other little boys, probably your age. What was it that captivated you?
Well, I was always obsessed by the shapes of airplanes. I loved making models when I was a kid. I loved going to air shows with my parents. And, you know, we flew... my father was born in Belgium, so we went back to Belgium occasionally when I was a kid. And, you know, as much as I love flying, I loved looking at the airplanes parked at the gate and thinking about where they would go and where they'd come from, even if, you know, as a child I didn't have quite the words for it. To me, they're just beautiful creations. They're perhaps the best example of how form follows function. And they're sculpted by air, and to me... Even now, they look like what I think they looked like to me when I was a kid, which is a dream come true.
In fact, you describe being a young boy at Kennedy Airport and seeing a plane from Saudi Arabia. I guess, well, I don't know if it was flying over your head, but certainly landing at the airport and just seeing the motto or the monogram on the airplane just spoke to you.
Yeah, we had gone to JFK. I grew up in Western Massachusetts. We'd gone to JFK to pick up a cousin from Belgium who was coming to live with us for a while. And we got there. We got to JFK early, and we parked on the old Pan Am terminal on the top of that building. And I guess we had some time, or maybe my dad had made time and taken us there with some time to spare. And I remember watching this plane park from Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I didn't know a lot about Saudi Arabia then or perhaps even exactly where it was, but I knew it was far and hot. And you know, this was March, I think, and it was very, very cold. We'd driven down the Taconic Parkway you know, past big snow drifts, and I just couldn't get my head around the fact that plane was going to open its doors, and people who had boarded it in a place like Riyadh or Jeddah were going to walk out into this other world, and of course now we do that all the time with airplanes, and it's something we almost shouldn't get used to. It's such an extraordinary change to the way we live, to the way we think about the planet.
Did you think then, I want to be a pilot or I want to be able to travel the world?
Well, I knew I wanted to travel, but it didn't occur to me that becoming a pilot was a practical possibility. We were pretty far from any major airport. We didn't have any neighbors who were pilots. I didn't have any family who'd been in the Air Force or worked for the airlines. So to me, it seemed as unlikely as becoming an astronaut. It didn't seem like something that would be a practical possibility. But, of course, I did hope to travel as much as I could.
You did take flying lessons as a teenager. I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but I'm trying to imagine what it was like that very first time you could take off and land an airplane by yourself.
Well, my first solo flight came later, actually. It came when I started my official flight training. And it is an extraordinary feeling. You're suddenly up there and, you know, it's like driving the first time you go driving by yourself with an extra dimension and quite a few extra miles per hour.
Yes.
It's an extraordinary feeling. Every pilot will remember their first solo flight. Mine was in an airport east of Phoenix, where we were based for our training, and And yeah, it was mm-hmm. up and away.
And you said, "Holy moly, here we go."
I think I said some slightly saltier words.
That we can't say on the radio, exactly. But what's interesting to me, too, is obviously you've had this lifelong passion for airplanes and for flying. But before becoming a pilot, you get a PhD in history. You work in the business world. I mean, were you sort of gearing for that right moment to say, you know what, I'm going to be a pilot?
Well, I had gone on an academic track. I'd studied history in college, and then I did a master's. I started a PhD. I didn't actually finish it. And I always say I did the P.
The P of the PhD.
Yeah. Yeah. maybe the first part of the P, just the vertical line. And I was studying African history, and as part of my research, I was meant to go to Kenya for a year. And so I arrived in Nairobi, and I had this kind of realization that, to me, almost the most exciting part of the trip had already taken place. Uh-huh. And I thought, wow, I really should. You know, I'm so in love with airplanes. I'm not so sure. I feel so strongly about writing a PhD. So let me think about a way to make it happen as a career. I came back to the U.S. and I wanted to get a job that would allow me to fly a lot. And some of my friends from college had gone into consulting, and they were always complaining about the flying, saying, "Oh my God, I've got to go to L.A. every week." And I thought, wow, that sounds great. You get to go on an airplane every week. Even as a passenger, yeah. And so I did that for a few years, and I did a lot of overseas flights with overseas clients, mm-hmm. and did a lot of flying on the airline I now work for. So I met some pilots then that I work for and that I work with now, which is a nice coincidence.
Well, you know, a 747, I have to say, as a passenger, I mean, it looks so huge.
It is. It is a big plane. It's not the biggest anymore, but I like to say it's still the best looking. And it's such an unusual shape. I mean, if somebody described it to you and said, you know, we're going to have this great big plane, we're going to put a big bump in the front of it, you wouldn't necessarily think that would look good. And yet it does. I often wonder if it looks like a natural form to us, like the head of a bird maybe. And we're sort of drawn to it for that reason.
I mean, shape seems to matter to you, the shape of an airplane.
Yeah, it's something we talk about. I think a lot of pilots think about what makes a good-looking airplane. And, you know, when a new airplane comes on the scene, you know, we'll often talk about it. And my favorite one that's come out recently is the 787 Dreamliner, which is Boeing's newest creation. I think it's a great-looking airplane. And hopefully I'll fly mm-hmm. that someday.
You know, I have to say, and I don't have a severe fear of flying, but I sort of go through the mental gymnastics of thinking, okay, these are my last few days on Earth. What do I want to do? But once I get into the plane, I figure, well, whatever happens, happens. But I have to say, there is something thrilling and a little scary looking out the window as the plane is, you know, speeding down the runway, and you watch that liftoff. And it is a beautiful thing. And, you know, as someone who doesn't really understand exactly a little bit about air pressure, as I understand it, above and below the wings, that's what the liftoff is all about. Can you kind of explain the mechanics of that?
Well, I think the most amazing thing about actually performing a takeoff, especially in a large plane, is this sense that when you first start out, all you're doing is driving, essentially. I mean, you're steering the plane using initially just the nose wheel, and yet as you get faster and faster, as the plane picks up speed, the what we call the control surfaces, which are the panels in the tail and the wings that move up or down or left or right to control the plane through the air, they start to work, and they start to work more and more even though you're still on the ground. And so when you're going down the runway at high speed, you really do leave behind the sense of driving, and what you're left with, even before you take flight, is the sense that you're flying along the runway.
Wow.
Gathering the required speed that you've calculated. And then once you reach that speed, then you pull the nose back, and there's this amazing moment of poise, which I tried to describe in the book, where they... Now, if you're in the rear of the plane, you actually descend a little bit before you go up, because the plane... It's called rotation, and at that moment the nose rises and the tail drops, and before you get into the air, anybody sat behind that point is actually experiencing a small descent before they come, before the whole plane takes flight. And so there is that moment of I wouldn't say hesitation, but there's that moment of poise, which I really love as a passenger, as well as a pilot, where it's like you suddenly feel the power of the Enterprise, and of all the engineering that's gone into it, and all the power, and then you're climbing away, and you raise the gear, and the next time the wheels touch the air, it'll be 14 hours away, 6,000 miles away, Singapore, Buenos Aires, Sydney.
What's V1 speed? Something I knew nothing about. What is that?
V1 is the last safe speed at which the takeoff can be stopped. So all of our planes are heavily overpowered, and one of the reasons they're overpowered is so that at a certain after the V1 speed, even if there was an engine failure, the takeoff would be continued safely, and the climb would all be conducted safely. So it's the speed at which the takeoff will be continued. Before that speed, you would stop for an engine problem, for example. After that speed, you'd continue the takeoff, and the entire regulatory system around how much power you need for takeoff and how much weight you can carry is all based around that speed. And that speed, it depends on the weather conditions as well as the weight of the airplane and the length of the runway and that, things like that.
What kind of speed are we talking about?
On a 747, it could be 150 knots, which is sort of 165, 170 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm. What do you do mentally, maybe even physically, mentally? How do you prepare for a long flight on a 747? Are there things you do?
Before each flight, of course, we have an extensive briefing with the crew where we meet the other pilots we're flying with as well as the flight attendants. So we'll have a briefing in our office at the airport, and then on the flight deck, the pilots will have another briefing which relates to the technical aspects of the departure and what are the significant features today that are different from perhaps the last time we flew. I find that in terms of the non-technical side of things, I often like to go for a walk in the afternoon, especially if I'm flying in the evening. I try to get a nap before I go, and try to do things that sort of feel connected to home before leaving it in such a dramatic fashion.
Leaving the Earth, and you do walk the plane as you describe it too. Walk around when you look at the plane.
Yeah, we do this, and this is something that every pilot, no matter how small or large a plane they're flying, will be familiar with. It's called the exterior inspection, or more colloquially, the walk around. And so you just walk around the plane, and of course there's all sorts of engineering checks that have been done, but the final check is the pilot walking around the plane that he or she is about to take across the world. So you're doing the final visual inspection. On a Cessna, it doesn't take very long at all. On a 747, just the distance you have to walk adds up. And of course, you need a much more powerful flashlight on your if you're doing a 747 walk around at night than you would on a smaller plane. But it's one of these lovely traditions that is one of the few things that continues from a small plane to the very largest.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I'd love to have you read a section from the book after this very short break. Talking with Mark Van Honecker, and he is a pilot, flies 747s out of London. He also writes, and he's got a new book. It's called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. To join the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you just join us, Mark Van Honecker is our guest. He's a pilot, flies 747s out of London on long flights all over the world. He's also a regular contributor to the New York Times, a columnist for Slate. He's been a pilot for about a dozen years, and he's got a new book called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. And Mark, I'd love to have you read a section from the book. It's a chapter called Lift.
Yeah, so Lift was is the introduction to the book, and it's sort of setting up why it is I love to fly. And so I'll just start with this third to last paragraph.
Perfect.
When travelers move between points on the globe so different in culture, language, and history, London, Tokyo, for example, the imaginative distance can be as vast as the physical gap in the air above them. Like the music you love best, this mental distance feels partly external and partly your own. And so high above the world, open to more of the planet and the sky than any species has the right to see, we find room for introspection in one of the last places we might have thought to look for it. When I was 13 and got my first portable cassette player and headphones and began to choose music for myself, I asked my brother if pilots were allowed to listen to music while they flew. He answered that he wasn't sure, but he thought not. He was right. But as passengers, we are all given these increasingly rare, quiet hours in which there is nowhere we have to go and nothing we have to do. Our hours in which we are alone with our thoughts and music and the moving picture of our own journeys. Then we blink, and suddenly we see again the Earth we're flying over. From the window seat, our focal point crosses between the personal and the planetary so smoothly that such movement seems to hint at a new species of grace that we would come to only in the sky. Whatever our idea of the sacred, our simplest questions, how the one relates to the many, how time equates to distance, how the present rests on the past as simply as our lights lie on each night's darkened sphere, are rarely framed as clearly as they are by the oval window of an airplane. We look through it, over snow-capped cordilleras, in the last red turn of the day, or upon the shining night palmistry of cities, and we see that the window is a mirror briefly raised above the world.
And that's our guest, pilot Mark Van Honecker, reading from his new book called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. And what's so interesting, and it's really a reminder, because I think, and this is from a passenger's perspective, air travel is such a hassle these days that the thought that once you get inside this airplane and you've, you know, wrestled your suitcase or whatever over your head is you do have time and you have time to in ways that we don't really have here on planet Earth. And I think this passage is a reminder that we can just sort of let our mind drift. You talk about the imaginative distance, this time of introspection, even looking out the window.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, in one sense, the book is about the kind of things that we see as pilots. But I also really wanted to emphasize why I love to fly as a passenger. My friends always laugh at me when I check in for a flight and I say, oh, can I have a window seat? And they say, oh, you've got six windows at work. Why do you need a window seat? But I really love to fly as a passenger. And all the more so, the more connected we are on the ground. I mean, that airplane mode is really a gift. Just to shut off for a while and look out of the world and to think about, you know, no matter where you're going. I mean, maybe you're just going on a business trip, which isn't maybe that exciting, but maybe you're flying to the country your parents came from. Maybe you're going to back to the place that you grew up in. You know, and in that case, both the origin and the destination of that flight are meaningful to you. And in between is all this space that we kind of move through, and yet we don't understand. And to descend to a new place that or an old place, and to watch it resolve from that kind of abstract high distance into the individual, you know, trees that we'll walk through in a few minutes after we leave the airport is still an extraordinary experience.
We focus so much on things like jet lag, especially if there are transatlantic flights or you're flying to some far-flung place. You write about something called place lag, which I frankly had never thought of, but the more I read, the more I thought I think you're really on to something here.
Well, place lag was the best term I could come up with for that sense of kind of wonder and disconnect in some ways when you walk out of an airport on the far side of the world. You know, the longest flight I do now is to Singapore, so we leave London in the evening. I'll have a whole day in London. I'll go for a run in the park and have dinner, and then I'll go to the airport, and I'll get on this plane, and then we'll fly to Singapore, and we'll conduct the descent and the approach and the landing. We'll go through customs, and suddenly we're on the bus going to town, and it's late afternoon or evening again, and all around us are people driving through Singapore, listening to their radio stations and having their ordinary days, and you can see the groceries in the cars in the car seat next to them, and you kind of think, you know, how is it that you know all this was going on and would be going on if I hadn't gotten on a plane, and yet planes, you know, bring us into these worlds so quickly, and so, you know, we don't have to spend 8 months at sea or 2 years traveling overland. We can do it in 14 hours, and that, I think that will always seem wondrous to us. And just like jet lag, I think it's something we'll never get used to.
And I often say to myself and to whoever I'm traveling with, how did we get here? How did this work? How could I have started in Philadelphia and ended up, you know, 8 or 9 hours later in Berlin?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think we evolved as a species to grow up and to live in a few dozen square miles of territory and to be able to cross these kinds of distances now is just extraordinary. And of course, pilots and airline crew in general will experience that even more severely because, you know, I could, you know, we don't just go from Tokyo to London, but a few days later we go to, we go to Los Angeles, or and then we go on to Accra. I often find you know, dirt on the bottom of my running shoes, and I can't even remember what continent it's from. And it's quite an extreme version of what any traveler will be familiar with.
Jet lag, though, is a real thing, and as a pilot, you know, flies all over the world. How do you deal with that?
Well, jet lag, in some ways, it really depends on the length on how long we're away. I mean, a lot of the places we go we don't actually stay long enough to experience jet lag. And of course, a business traveler or a tourist who's going to a new city, if you're going to be staying there for a week, maybe longer, you're going to want to get onto local time. You're going to want to have breakfast when the people around you are having breakfast and so forth. Whereas for us, that's true if we're staying for 3 or 4 days. But if we're going back the next night, we might ignore local time completely. And so jet lag is something that we in some ways have to face less than our customers do.
So do you live, because I guess you work out of London, so do you live in Greenwich Mean Time? Is that your time zone?
Yeah, I mean, I try to stay when I'm working. I don't change my watch, no matter where I am. I find it more confusing to change it than to not change it. I still try to get onto local time a little bit, maybe in the Far East, just because I want to see the life of the cities that we're in. But you know, each airline crew member will have their own. Will find out what works best for their own body, and some people will stay on local time wherever they are. Others will stay on their home time.
Let me ask you about pilots' voices, because you know, before taking off, we hear them tell us, you know, what the weather's going to be like, and it's always in this very reassuring voice. And I wonder whether pilots go to voice school to be able to say to passengers who might be nervous, "I got this. You're in good hands."
Well, we do get training on how to make announcements, on what kinds of information are interesting to some passengers. You know, a lot of on some routes, people tend to be going more on vacation than for business, so we might tell them more about the route we're flying. I do a lot of flights from New York to London, and many of the passengers on those routes are very, very regular travelers. Some of them do it every week. Some of them fly that route more than we do. And of course, they want to get to bed right away on a night flight. So we try to tailor it a little bit to the route. Whereas if we're flying, let's say, to Las Vegas or to California in the summer, you know, we can guess that a lot of the people on the plane are going to be going on vacation, and we try to make it a little more momentous in terms of describing the route and the weather that's waiting for them, which is, well, in California, it's almost always better than wherever you started, isn't it?
So. Yes, it is. But the voice, you know, that nice, deep, resonant, reassuring voice that just sort of comes with the job.
I don't know. I guess, yeah. Maybe in the interview, that's what they were testing for.
I don't know. And I have to say, I've rarely heard a female pilot's voice. Maybe I don't fly enough. Is that a rarity?
Well, it's one of these historical trends, which is being reversed. I fly with more and more female pilots on my training course that I went through. Maybe 4 or 5 were female. One of my best friends on the 747 is a woman I did my training with. One of the reasons you may not hear the announcements so much is that typically, not exclusively, but typically the announcements are made by the captain. And to become a captain takes, a couple decades in the business usually. So there is a further lag between who's actually in the cockpit and then who's making the announcements, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So in the years to come,
we'll be hearing more female captains speaking to us. Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Mark von Honecker, and he is a pilot. He pilots 747s out of London on flights all over the world. He's also a writer. He's a regular contributor to the New York Times, a columnist for Slate, and he's got a new book called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. And to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. One of the things that you write about in your book that I thought was interesting is that there are so many parts of the world where there's really no radar. Whether you say is in Greenland, there's really no radar. I guess over large parts of Africa, there's no radar, or perhaps even GPS, and that you have to fly using beacons and waypoints. Describe how that works.
Yeah, I mean, those aren't exclusive phenomena. We often fly with beacons in places where we do have radar, but these beacons are stations on the ground that broadcast a signal which allows you to tell either your distance or your bearing or both. And these beacons are very, very old. A lot of them have been around nearly as long as flying. There's some in the U.S. that date back to the days of the original airmail flights.
Really?
The beacon was a fire. I mean, they were building a fire.
Wow.
And so some of those beacons are in the same place. And they have this strange quality where the beacons are often in small places. I mean, there are beacons in big places like at JFK, for example, but there are ones in smaller places which really can elevate a small place up into the sky in a way you'd never expect. And just around Philadelphia, there's a beacon in Pottstown, not Pottsville, where the Yuengling Brewer is, but there's one in Pottstown. There's one in Modena. So, I mean, most people would think of Modena as the city in Italy, but a pilot might well think of the beacon near Philadelphia. There's a beacon in East Texas. Most people wouldn't think of the village north of Philadelphia near Allentown, I think it is, but there's a beacon there, so pilots will know East Texas as a Pennsylvania place. There's one near Robben Island or on Robben Island on the way to Cape Town. So when you fly to Cape Town, you'll have this kind of interaction with this island that was Mandela's prison for many other people's prisons for hundreds of years, and yet it has this place in the modern sky that you'd never expect.
I remember seeing a couple of years ago an aerial map of North and South Korea at night, and you saw in South Korea lots of, you know, little twinkling. They weren't twinkling on the page, but lots of light. I mean, it looked like a typical Western country, and the picture of North Korea was almost completely black, and I just thought, wow. I mean, that told me so much about those two countries.
Yeah, and you get that sense from what is lit on the world. I mean, I love flying at night. The night chapter in the book was the first one I wrote. It was the one that was easiest to write in a way because it's so closely tied to what I love about flying. And, you know, part of that is the stars or the auroras that last for hours. But a lot of it is what you see on the earth below. And there are places where you essentially see no lights at all over. I haven't flown over North Korea, but mm-hmm. over large portions of the Sahara, you sometimes have this experience where you only see one light. Or Belgium has. I don't think they do it quite anymore, but for a long time, every road in Belgium was lit. They had a policy of lighting every road in the country, and that actually made it so bright that you could see the border of Belgium. When flying over on a very clear night, you could sort of follow the line where they stopped lighting the smallest country lanes, and then when you fly up the East Coast, for example, you see that from Washington to Boston is just this very, very dense corridor. Or if you fly over the Nile, which I do a lot on flights from the Middle East back to London, you see the Nile as a river of light, essentially, because nearly all economic activity goes on along the banks of the river. And so that produces light, which is kind of an inverse shadow of the river. And you wouldn't think of rivers as something you could see at night, but so often that's exactly what you see.
Well, this is a silly question. So how much are you actually looking out the window when you're flying in a 747? And how much are you looking at the instruments?
Well, it's a mix. I mean, the instruments are still an important part of flying, but even more fundamental is what's called the lookout. We're still looking out of the plane, just as much as you would when you were driving. And it's sort of in addition to all the radar and all the navigation systems, there's still this fundamental task of looking out the window. And at night, that requires the lights in the cockpit to be turned down very dim. So the screens are lit, but the overhead lighting is at a very, very low level. And so your eyes acclimate to the outside world in a way which makes it very, very vivid. You can get the same effect from the passenger cabin if you maybe put a blanket around the window, so you can block out all the light from inside the cabin.
You write about turbulence, and I was actually happy to read this, which is that it's not something to be afraid of. And I have to say, when I'm in an airplane and it's, you know, being sort of jostled around, I think, uh-oh. You're saying, don't worry about it?
Yeah. One of my colleagues, actually quite a few pilots of British Airways have written books. And one of my colleagues, his name is Steve Allwright, which is such a great name for somebody who's writing a book about turbulence.
Exactly.
We always joke about that. For Steve Allwright, I mean, you couldn't ask for a better name. So he co-wrote a book called Flying with Confidence. And he also did a video that's shown on the plane. And, you know, his line is really the best one. He says, turbulence is uncomfortable, but it's never dangerous.
Oh, and why not? And I mean, what is happening?
The degree to which the planes are engineered is so far beyond the atmospheric conditions you'd ever experience that, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, can wake people up on a long flight. It can, you know, mean that we're not allowed to serve hot drinks. But that's, you know, coffee is the most dangerous thing about turbulence.
Burning yourself with your cup of coffee?
Yeah, yeah. That's it's really the standards to which the planes are built is so extraordinary.
We're almost up on a break here. You fly at around, what, 35,000 feet? What is the typical flight or height of a 747's flight?
Oh, well, it really depends. It depends on first of all, on the weight of the plane. I mean, the 747 has, depending on how far it's going, it can weigh as little as maybe 270 tons or as much as 390. And that weight, those are metric tons, that weight you know, influences how high we can fly. And then, of course, the winds. But normally we start lower, so we might start at 29,000 or 31,000 feet. And then during the course of the flight, all things being equal, we would climb up to get, to more efficient altitudes.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Mark, I'd love to have you read another section from your book after this very short break about clouds. Talking with Mark Van Honecker. He's a pilot 747s. He's also a writer. His book is called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I see some people want to join us. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mark Van Honecker. He's a pilot, and his book is called Skyfaring. It's part memoir, part explanation of the mechanics of flight, also part description of the beauty that he observes from altitudes high above the earth. To join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Mark, I'd love to have you read another section from the book under the chapter titled Water, and this is about cumulus clouds.
Sure. Fluffy cumulus are the clouds I love best. They're flying high on cloud nine in seventh heaven. They're walking on air. They're the clouds that fill Rococo artworks, or that are painted upon faux skylights in the ceilings of the New York Public Library in Versailles. Even these, the most exuberant of clouds, seem to possess a slow, dignified consciousness, a feeling that's enhanced by our ability, from the windows of airplanes, to directly observe not only their movements, but also their barely perceptible growth. If you have ever been on a whale watch, moving among clouds has something of the same quality, the sense that these enormous lounging creatures are directed by steadier lights, that they can hardly notice something as small and jittery as us, and inhabit frames of time that we've lost. Of course, 747s do not linger in the playful summer cumulus that provides such delight to new pilots. Except for brief periods around takeoff and landing, we mostly see these happy clouds from above, with the pleasure they give, like a memorable tale or joke, often takes the form of an unexpected reversal. Seen from cruising altitude, cumulus clouds, the connected parentheses or arcs cut from circles, as children draw them, lie surprisingly close on the world. Like fireworks, as we understand them from an airplane, they are basically ground events.
I really like that chapter. And I love, in particular, when you talk about happy clouds. So you think of cumulus as happy clouds.
Yeah, they, you know, we see so many clouds and from all sides. And I really do think that, the sort of Simpsons caliber, you know, the
yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think those capture the imagination for an obvious reason, and they are ground events in the way that they're often called up by heat, by the sun's heat. We often see a coastline. Before we see the coastline, we see the clouds that have formed above it because the earth is heating faster than the water, and air is rising off and forming these clouds, and it kind of forms a map in water, which we often see before we see the land that it's encoding.
Is your title Skyfaring taken from the word seafaring?
Yeah, I was really struck by the nautical dimensions of flying, and I knew some of these before I got going, but on the book. But a lot of them came out as I was writing it. I mean, even the term aeronautical, if we unpack it to its roots, or the word airport. I mean, they are these ports of the air, and you know, I love the name of the airport in Phoenix, which is Sky Harbor Airport, which is a kind of redundancy, which really echoes that heritage. And so much of the language of the sky is nautical. We speak of hulls and fleets and forward and aft and rudders and tillers and cabins and galleys and knots and our wake and our technical logs. And of course, you know, so many journeys are to cities. You know, the reason that some cities exist at all is because they're ports, they were ports, and so then they grew up as cities, and now we fly planes to them. So each journey to Boston, to Singapore, to Cape Town is echoing that nautical heritage. And I tried hard to find a title that would reflect that.
Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Joe from Harleysville joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Joe?
Hello.
Yeah, you're on the air. Go ahead. I'm going to ask Joe's question.
Hello.
I'm here. Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Hey, just a quick question for your guest. How did you break into the industry? Did you come in through the military? Did you go to like a university like Emory, you know, to learn aeronautical, you know, engineering courses, things like that?
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was very lucky. I had a European passport in addition to my U.S. one. My father was born in Belgium, and I had always wanted to work for British Airways, and it was the sort of iconic airline that I aspired to when I was a kid. And they had a training program, a cadet program, where they take you in from no flying hours, although you can have some. I did have some flying hours, all the way up to a jet license. So I applied for that course and went through it. I don't think there's a direct analog to that in the U.S. A lot of readers have written into me to ask about how to get into it, and I wish I was better able to answer those questions. I know, obviously, a lot of people come through the military, and then there are schools like the University of North Dakota and Embry-Riddle, as Joe said, that are, you know, other paths into it. But yeah, however, if you know someone who wants to be a pilot, it's definitely worth digging into it. I've never met somebody who regrets their choice of becoming a pilot.
Can't say that about every profession, can you?
No.
We have a comment from Cletus says, can you talk about drones potentially getting in the way of airplanes? And I was reading recently that there was one day, I think there was something like 12 incidents of drones and large commercial aircraft at least being in close proximity. Is that a problem?
That's not something that I've ever come across. One of the things about the scale of the 747 and the journeys it makes is that they tend to be to the very, very largest airports. My understanding is that those drones are appearing at smaller airports. And clearly it's a matter for regulators to look at.
We have an email from Gail. She says, my husband is also a pilot, the 777 fleet. He tells me about waypoints with funny names. I can't remember any. Can Mark share some? Do you remember some funny names of waypoints?
Oh, God, you're going to have to stop me from talking about waypoints.
Go ahead.
They're one of my favorite aspects of flying. So these are these five-letter codes, and the trick is they have to be pronounceable because pilots from all over the world will want to be able to understand clearly what a controller has said. And the U.S., we think of the U.S. as being sort of national in its scale. But in fact, when it comes to waypoints, we've been incredibly local. So Kansas City has barbecue, which is B-A-R-B-Q. It has spicy. It has ribs.
That's great.
Near Boston, there's chowder, which is C-H-W-D-H, which you kind of have to think about for a second if you're not familiar with the cuisine there. And then lobster ending with an A, and then claw with two W's. And Nimoy is a great one for Boston. Leonard Nimoy was from Boston. There's Light, which I think with two T's or maybe a Y, which is over Boston Lighthouse. Philadelphia has cheese, which is C-H-E-A-Z, and then you'll never guess what comes next, steak, S-T-A-Y-K. and that's not – those are 9 miles apart, which must be the biggest cheesesteak in in history. but, you know, pilots are going to be told proceed direct cheese and then steak. And There's lots of ones off the coast of Canada. There's that relate to there's one called Banks for the Grand Banks Fishing Ground. There, for some reason, near St. Louis is a pair of waypoints called Annie and Lennox. And I tried. I was emailing when I was writing the book. I was writing to the FAA saying, "Why? Did she have a did she have a concert there?" And I never got an answer. I think the only possible answer is that someone there was a fan of the Eurythmics, and it'll be up in the sky for all time now.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm also looking at an article that was in the Daily Mail, and this is about some of the secret language of the cabin crew, Whizzer. I'm turning my pages here. The Heavy, There and Back, The Director. So there's a secret language that you all speak as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of technical words that relate to flying. And, you know, I was really... Just in general, I'm kind of interested in the language of different fields and the way people talk about things, and that was something I really wanted to bring out in the book. Not just the geographic names, which are hopefully as interesting to any armchair traveler as they were to me when I was poring over an atlas, but also a lot of the technical language. I really tried to emphasize that it has its own sort of music to it, and that it's a field. Yeah. Like each field, it has its a kind of musicality to its language, and that I wanted to capture as best I could.
A Facebook comment from Judy. She says, "I'm enjoying this interview very much. My dad was a fighter pilot in World War II. It's only been recently I've discovered not all kids were taught to drive the car the way my dad taught his kids. For example, we were taught to always do a visual inspection of our vehicle before driving off and many more unique items that were on our driving checklist." But that sounds very familiar to what you do as a pilot checking out that airplane.
Yeah, it does indeed. Driving, one of the funny things about becoming an airline pilot is that suddenly driving starts to seem incredibly dangerous. When I get on the highway after a flight, I sometimes can't believe, you see people and you think, who's directing this? Who's controlling this? Who's mm-hmm. saying who can go when? And compared to the very highly controlled environment of civil aviation, a highway is complete chaos.
Well, and it's interesting. We talked very briefly about the fear of flying, but I wonder how much of it is control. You're sitting in the back of an airplane, so you can't exactly see where it's going. But I think statistically, it's much safer to fly than it certainly is to drive a car.
Yeah, clearly, all the statistics show that. I speculate a little bit on why in the book, maybe why some people don't always feel comfortable flying, and I come to this possibly the same conclusion you did, which is that I think some people don't like to not be able to see the direction in which they're moving. Even on a train, you can, because the windows are so much larger, you can kind of get a sense of what's coming next. Mm-hmm. Whereas on a plane, let alone if you're not in a window seat, but even in a window seat, that view is in some ways more limited. So I can see why people would might react that way.
Let me get Paul from, looks like, Newtown Square to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, buddy.
Morning.
I love the show as
Thank
usual.
You.
And I
Thank
have
you.
To say that I share so much with this guy, Mark, since a kid, loving it. And absolutely. My father flew in the Second World War. He's the last of his plane. He used to fly Navigator and Lancasters over Germany, Second World War. He's still alive at 91. I definitely want to buy him your book. I felt the same way flying my first flight in a big plane was coming from England to the U.S. August 5th, 1967,
wow.
on a Boeing 707,
wow.
and absolutely thrilled with it all. And I always want to go up in the cabin and be allowed to see through the front window as the plane's flying, but I guess I'll never be allowed to.
Not anymore.
One thing I wanted to know was, as a pilot and co-pilots, with automation coming in, do you foresee a time when a co-pilot's not going to be used? And do you guys, are you allowed to have a nap while the other guy keeps control of the big computer that runs everything?
Paul, thanks for the call. Mark, go ahead.
Well, I think that my guess is that the two-pilot operation is going to be around for quite a while to come. I mean, so much of the procedures and the training and the regulatory structure is built around that. Even the checklists are designed for two. Atul Gawande has written that great book called The Checklist Manifesto, I think, about how the checklist is this very simple but very effective safety tool. And you know, one of the things that's most effective about it is that it's done by two people. So one person is reading it and the other person is answering it. And then the person reading it is checking that the answers are correct. Mm. And so there's the whole – even the way the cockpits are built is designed for two pilots. You know, we have a – you know, we each have a set of screens on our own side, and then there's a whole set of shared equipment in between. And so the – I don't know. I wouldn't bet on what's going to happen in 100 years, but I think for 20, 30 years to come, there will still be two pilots up there. And now they're often on a to answer Paul's second question, we often have a third or fourth pilot on our very longest flights, and that is simply due to the length of the flight and the regulatory regime that governs flying hours. So in the 747, we actually have a bedroom in the cockpit.
Oh, wow. So you can take a nap.
Yeah, so when two of us are flying the one or both the other pilots, if it's a four crew trip, we'll be in the bunk, and it's a very odd experience until you get used to it to be going to sleep in this room on a plane that nobody really knows about. And in fact, I opened the book with a description of what it's like to wake up in that bunk and then walk out into a cockpit over a different country at a different time of day, a different day, in fact. Yeah, that's one of the well-kept secrets of the 747 and some other planes like it.
Well, I've always wanted to ask a pilot this question. Do we really need to turn off our electrical devices for takeoff and landing?
Well, you know, those rules change occasionally based on the latest regulatory information. So whatever the rules are on the plane, I certainly follow those rules, of course. I have to say, when I was growing up, I was such a fan of listening to the music, listening to my Walkman or Discman or whatever it was then, looking out the window. And I was really, as a passenger, I was not happy when they changed the rules and said you couldn't listen to music during takeoff and landing. I guess they started changing those rules, I don't know when it was, eight or 10 years ago. And so I'm very happy again to think of all the passengers listening to just the song they picked out for arrival or departure.
Well, we have picked out a song to end this hour. Mark Van Honecker, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. The book is called Skyfaring, A Journey with a Pilot. And we are going to close things out with Max Richter's Written on the Sky. This is from the 2004 album The Blue Notebooks. And our guest says that he loves this piece of music because it works so well for takeoff. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.